Everyone's agreed to substantially up their commitment. They're going to up it at levels that they've never thought of before.
President Trump declares victory with NATO. Just don't ask the other member nations that. It's Friday, July 13th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also ahead, India named the most dangerous country for women. Extreme weather threatens much of the globe. And saving the Asian pangolin. It's all coming up today on VOA's Asia Edition. Welcome to VOA Asia. China Thursday said it has not been in touch with the United States about restarting trade negotiations over an escalating tariff war. Earlier, U.S. officials announced they were preparing to impose duties on another $200 billion in Chinese imports at the end of August over what the Trump administration calls Beijing's predatory economic policies. A Chinese Commerce Ministry spokesman says China does not want a trade war with the U.S., but it doesn't fear one and would fight if necessary. The ministry called on U.S. firms doing business in China to lobby Washington against its tariff policy. A survey of U.S. businesses operating in China revealed an overwhelming majority opposed the use of tariffs to tackle issues like forced technology transfers. Meanwhile, South Korean carmaker Hyundai's labor union warned Thursday that tariffs could jeopardize 20,000 U.S. jobs. Patrick Chovanich, chief strategist at the New York-based Silvercrest Asset Management Company, told VOA's Victor Beatty that Beijing has ways to respond to this latest round of threatened tariffs.
There are some people who argue that because the U.S. imports more from China than vice versa, that we can outclass them in terms of tariffs and they just have no way of responding. But, you know, they can crack down on all kinds of things. They can make it virtually impossible for any U.S. imports to enter the country, not just slap tariffs on them, but basically bar them. They can also crack down on companies that are American companies that are doing business in China and selling inside of China and hurt their profits that way. So there are a lot of different ways, even if we just stick to economics and not even geopolitics, that China can retaliate against the United States.
Some U.S. business groups and lawmakers from Mr. Trump's own Republican Party who support free trade are critical of the escalating tariff war. Republican-controlled Senate voting overwhelmingly in favor of a non-binding resolution calling on Congress to have a role in implementing such tariffs.
Republicans, you know, used to believe in free trade and used to argue against putting tariffs, and particularly protective tariffs, in order to protect U.S. industries. That's come under a lot of pressure, obviously, from the Trump administration. But perhaps even more importantly than the ideology is the practical impact on the home districts or home states of some of these representatives in Congress. Agriculture is one of the key things being targeted by not just China, but other countries, Canada, Mexico, the EU, that are currently in trade disputes with the United States. If you're from a farm state, it might have voted for Donald Trump, but they're going to be, you know, hurting. Other countries are smart. They know that the way to put pressure on the United States over these tariffs isn't just economic pain, it's also political pain aimed at industries in key districts, and that's exactly what they're going to do.
The whole idea, of course, behind the tariffs is to change China's behavior. Will it lead to that? Could this prompt bilateral discussions to ease tensions?
So it's interesting that China's been able to portray itself as the champion of free trade against U.S. protectionism. And I would say that that doesn't fit the reality, but it's a void that China has filled because the Trump administration has basically championed protectionism and left that high ground open for China to grab. The United States has plenty of reasons to be upset with China over some of its trade practices, not just import tariffs on U.S. goods, but also that there are non-tariff trade barriers, there are barriers to U.S. investment in China, and there is theft of intellectual property from U.S. companies. So there's plenty for the U.S. to be upset about. A much better way of going about it is actually, instead of picking fights with all of our trading partners, is to work with a lot of our trading partners who agree with us about some of these Chinese practices and try to put international pressure on China. That makes it a lot harder for China to retaliate against the world instead of simply an isolated United States. I think that there are things that the United States is legitimately concerned about, But whether this is a productive way to get China to respond is another question.
Patrick Chovanec of Silvercrest Asset Management. Meanwhile, the U.S. said it has signed an agreement with China telecom company ZTE that could allow it to resume operations after being sanctioned by the U.S. for violating sanctions on Iran and North Korea. Chovanec said since its products require U.S. components, sanctions would have doomed ZTE. He said the company was thought to be part of a larger trade deal with China, and allowing it to resume operations as trade tensions increase will likely raise questions in Congress. These are among the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. North Korea fails to show up for talks with U.S. officials on returning the remains of American war dead from the Korean War. Police in Pakistan allegedly round up hundreds of supporters of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif a day before he's due to return to that country. A court in Vietnam jailed six for clashing with police during last month's nationwide protests. The U.S. military says a service member died Thursday of a wound sustained in combat in eastern Afghanistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. India has emerged as the most dangerous country in the world for women, according to a new survey by the Thomson Reuters Foundation. The survey is a repeat of a similar one conducted by the foundation in 2011, which then rated India as the fourth most dangerous country for women after Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Pakistan. The survey is not going over well with either the Indian government or field experts who have raised questions about the survey's methodology. Ritul Joshi has more from New Delhi.
From India's capital of New Delhi to the country's numerous small towns and villages, millions of women may be living in danger. That's the conclusion of a recent survey by the Thomson Reuters Foundation, which found India to be the most dangerous country in the world for women. But the Indian government insists the findings, based on a survey of 548 experts across the globe, is deeply flawed.
It has been conducted in a completely wrong manner. For India, only 101 women were consulted, of which only 50 of them in the country. The rest all live out of India.
Of the survey's six major categories, India fared the worst in three: sexual violence, human trafficking, and culture and religion.
In the entire South Asian region, preference for male babies is very high. Because of this, all kinds of things take place, including murders and torture.
There is also a rise in the reporting of cases. And it is very natural because of late, there is a growing awareness of law, legal provisions. Women are increasingly vocal about their rights. There is a growing sense of entitlement.
There are many countries where women are not free to speak, and media is not free to report. In many countries, laws are designed to harass women. For example, Sharia laws.
Recent cases, such as the gang rape of a little girl in the state of Jammu and Kashmir, have badly damaged India's reputation. But some Indian social scientists argue that rape and sexual harassment are not exclusive to India.
Right now, we are seeing more cases from the first world countries in the media. The hashtag MeToo campaign is an example. Sexual harassment is prevalent everywhere.
The Thomson Reuters Foundation acknowledges the poll is based only on the perceptions of experts and is not backed by hard data. But others say, instead of being angry over the survey's findings, perhaps India should take a long, hard look at why its reputation has suffered when it comes to the safety of women. Ritul Joshi, VOA News, New Delhi.
Happening now in Asia, Asian stocks closed higher on Thursday, with markets shaking off some of the trade jitters after the Trump administration announced a list of Chinese goods that may be subject to new tariffs. The Shanghai Composite paired all of Wednesday's losses, closing up 2.18%. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. Japan risks more severe weather and must find ways to alleviate disasters, a government spokesman said on Thursday, as intense heat and water shortages raised fear of disease among survivors of its worst weather disaster in 36 years. Torrential rains that struck western Japan a week ago have caused floods and landslides, killing at least 200 people. But Japan is not alone in seeing weather extremes. The World Meteorological Association warns the floods, heat waves, and other extreme weather conditions gripping many parts of the world are likely to continue as a consequence of accelerating climate change. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the WMO headquarters in Geneva.
While the world was fixated on the dramatic rescue from a cave in Thailand of 12 boys and their soccer coach, potentially deadly monsoon rains were gathering steam in the region. The World Meteorological Organization reports extreme weather conditions have dealt a deadly blow in many places, with blistering heat waves and disastrous precipitation forecast to continue this month. For example, it notes the recent catastrophic flooding in Japan, the worst in decades, has claimed at least 150 lives. WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis says the death toll is likely to climb. This in what she calls one of the world's best prepared countries when it comes to tackling disasters.
They are supremely well prepared, and so the magnitude of the casualties of the destruction that we're seeing now really is an indication of just how big and how extreme this was and how heavy the rainfall was in such a short period of time.
Other extreme weather events include drought and abnormally high temperatures in northern Europe. The WMO expects these conditions to prevail over the coming weeks. The WMO reports the United States has had the hottest June on record. Nullis notes the Los Angeles area in California continues to hit record high temperatures, such as 48.9 degrees Celsius in the city of Chino. Elsewhere in the world, she says a city in the Algerian Sahara Desert has reported temperatures of 51.3 degrees Celsius.
Climate change, as we always say, no specific event can be attributed to climate change, but what we're seeing is consistent with climate change scenarios. Extreme heat, consistent heat, persistent heat, and heavy precipitation.
WMO scientists say these extreme weather events are compatible with the general long-term trend of global warming caused by the emission of man-made greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. South Korea's president has pledged to increase trade with Singapore as part of a strategy to raise its economic influence in the region. President Moon Jae-in says the two countries agreed to, quote, invigorate mutual investment by significantly increasing the trade volume, currently at $20 billion. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories. This is VOA Asia. And VOA Asia continues. President Donald Trump declared victory Thursday at the conclusion of the NATO summit, saying he had won commitments from other countries to increase their defense spending. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said there was a new sense of urgency to increase military funding and credited Mr. Trump with having an impact. Reporter Henry Ridgewell at the NATO summit in Brussels told our VOA's Sarah Williams what is known about the spending commitments from NATO members.
There's very little detail, really, to add to the rhetoric of that increased commitment. As you say, Donald Trump told reporters here in his final press conference that he had secured a victory of sorts, that he had convinced allies through his own unique brand of diplomacy, really, that they had to increase defense spending and increase it much more quickly. Currently, the NATO target is 2% of GDP by the year 2024. And it's not clear whether any of Donald Trump's NATO allies agreed to increase spending at any quicker rate. Of course, his other NATO allies were asked that very question in their press conferences that followed, and none of them admitted or said put forward any concrete proposals that they would increase spending further. They simply spoke of the need for a continuing dialogue, the need to continue to make efforts towards NATO and towards defense spending. But certainly there are no declarations from NATO or declarations from other member states of any concrete commitments to any greater defense spending. So it's very difficult at the moment to see how Donald Trump's rhetoric about being able to secure these commitments are being matched by political reality.
Because I think Mr. Trump had indicated the day before that he was going to urge NATO allies commit to spending 4% of their gross domestic product as opposed to the 2% that he wanted.
That's right. He's been pushing for a much harder, a much faster increase in defense spending among all allies. And, well, the state of affairs at the moment is that several allies are struggling to meet the 2% target. Germany, for example, the second richest country in NATO, spends just over 1%, and its current strategy is to increase spending only very gently to 1.5% by the year 2025. So you get an idea of the scale of difference between what Donald Trump wants and what he's demanding and what European allies are really doing in reality. There's only 8 NATO countries this year who are on target to achieve that 2% of GDP target that you mentioned. So that leaves another 21 who will miss that target. But there is one thing that everyone here is agreed on in Brussels, even those who perhaps aren't the closest allies of Donald Trump, is that he has changed the game here. He has got far more countries to commit to increase their spending. The details perhaps are to be worked out another day, but the summit has focused very much on defense spending, and there are many more commitments that perhaps wouldn't otherwise be there if he weren't here in place.
Trump said at the end of the summit that he said before, we should say, he was a critic of NATO, almost indicating it was sort of past its usefulness. But he closed the summit saying that he believes in NATO. And he said the U.S. commitment to NATO remains very strong.
That's right. And I think we've seen a repeat of this dual track diplomacy, if you will, of Donald Trump. One thing he says to a domestic audience back home and he writes on his Twitter feed perhaps differs markedly from what he says in the bilateral meetings and in the press conferences and when he's among allies here. There has been criticism of that, of course, from many quarters, but his supporters and the president himself justifies it on the basis of his results. And he very much here claimed that those results are self-evident, that NATO members are increasing their defense spending much more quickly.
Reporter Henry Ridgewell speaking with VOA's Sarah Williams. This news alert from VOA Asia, Indian investigators have charged a politician from Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party with raping a teenager. Kuldeep Singh Sengar was charged with the 2017 rape of a 16-year-old girl whose father was later killed in custody, allegedly by Sengar's brother. All the big stories coming your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, pangolins are the world's most illegally trafficked animal. 8 species of the beautiful but elusive mammals can be found in Southeast Asia and in Africa, but as many as 300 are poached every day. Now a team of researchers in the UK are hoping to deter pangolin poaching through specialized fingerprint technology designed to identify poachers and bring them to justice. VOA's Julie Tabo explains.
Pangolins are shy, secretive animals. They have a coat of thick, overlapping scales, much like an armadillo, to protect themselves against predators. But demand for those scales is driving an illegal market, which is threatening their very existence.
If you can just grip the scale between your thumb and forefinger.
But now researchers in England have perfected a method of recovering the fingerprints of pangolin poachers from the animal's scales.
When we first brought it up, we brought the scales back. I loaded one up, put it into the gel scan, and when it came up, I just went, wow, yeah, we've got a fingerprint off that, and we were thrilled.
The forensic team used the international standard for recovering crime scene evidence, gel pads, which are pressed onto scales and then scanned to reveal rich details of the person who had held them. The easy-to-use, low-tech process makes it easier to prosecute.
It might not be as perfect as it is in a laboratory or in a controlled crime scene, but you can still gather evidence, and there's still methods and materials that you can use that will quickly get that evidence, get it to a safe environment, and do the analysis there.
Project collaborators included the Zoological Society of London and the UK Border Force, who are able to supply pangolin scales banned under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, CITES. The impact on the illegal trade in pangolins would be massive.
What it does is it gives us the ability to tie organized criminals to the pangolin scales so that not only are we finding the pangolin scales, but we are able to investigate those that are trafficking.
Without a remedy, pangolins will become extinct.
There are places where we've seen pangolins being wiped out already, and that's just going to continue to happen. So we need to find ways to tackle the trade, tackle the demand, stop the poaching in order to ensure this species can survive in the wild.
Christy Henderson is Senior Campaign Coordinator at PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
So not only are we killing them and using their body parts for little more than, you know, misguided tradition or pseudoscience, but these animals are endangered and we should be and need to be doing a lot more to protect them.
Wildlife and plant trafficking is the world's fourth biggest crime category, behind human trafficking, drugs and firearms, with an estimated value of between $17 to $23 billion annually. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
40 years ago this month, the first test tube baby was born in what is now called in vitro fertilization. British baby Louise Brown was born July 25th, 1978. She's now married with two children who were born naturally. A new exhibition at the Science Museum in London is showcasing the anniversary. VOA's Deborah Block has more.
The birth of the first test tube baby 40 years ago this month was greeted with joy, amazement, and mistrust. In vitro fertilization, or IVF, changed the world we live in.
There are literally millions of babies who've been born as a result of this pioneering treatment, and patients have the families that they ultimately longed for.
But the birth of baby Louise in 1978 was also viewed with suspicion and fear. Some groups thought IVF would cheapen the value of human life. At London Science Museum, an exhibition called IVF, 6 Million Babies Later, includes personal effects loaned by the Browns.
We have the baby tags and bracelets put on Louise at birth and on Leslie, her mother, in the hospital, which I just think is incredibly emotional and lovely.
It is estimated that 350,000 IVF babies are born each year worldwide. But there are also disappointments. About 70% of in vitro fertilizations fail, as would-be mother Emma Lake found out.
All my friends are at an age where they are having children, so I feel like I'm losing that connection with my peer group, and I think it's more about that feeling of being left behind.
However, IVF research may lead to breakthroughs that could help patients like her in the future.
I think the step change that everybody is looking for is that the science could get us to a stage where artificial or stem cell-based kind of sperm and egg can be created.
Scientists say the same technology that was used to bring baby Louise into this world will have delivered an estimated 400 million new babies by the end of this century. Deborah Block, VOA News.
And you've been listening to VOA Asia. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you'll come with us again on Monday. Until then, I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Have a great weekend.